Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msoucy, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on X, at Matthew Soucy. This show is available on iTunes and, like all of the podcasts here at WFYI, available on Spotify. Well, friends, it is just you and me, but we will dip into the archives in a little bit, inspired by a film I got to watch this week. I wound up seeing a film this week that is opening next week, so we'll talk about that. Apparently, I wanted to skip the Jamie Foxx, Tommy Lee Jones courtroom drama. And I'm starting to wonder if, where there was Scary Movie and not another, Vampire Sucks and Not Another Movie, where it's a movie parody of a genre. I'm wondering if Courtroom Movie will eventually come out. But anyway, we'll talk about the film I saw next week, because that's how things work. Also, the fact that I am in my final weekend of playing the role of Corin in Indie Bardfest's production of As You Like It, which you've been hearing about on these very airwaves. We have three more performances Friday night, Saturday night at 8 o'clock, and Sunday at 2:30 at Mud Creek Players. You can go to IndieBardFest.com for all the information. Troilus and Crescent is also running this weekend, and then we'll get into some other shows. But if you want to come check that out, that would be great. But I did get to watch some films on video at home, catching up on the pile there. We have some dead people we like. And as I said, we'll go around the horn. We'll grab a pencil and we'll dip into the archives. But first off, raising a glass to Phyllis Coates, who is best known. When did she die? Earlier this week. But she is best known as playing Lois Lane in the first season of the television series The Adventures of Superman. But her credits go all the way back to 1946. Before that, appearing in a number of short films like So You Want to Be a Muscle Man, So You Want to Get Rich Quick. My Foolish Heart is one of her uncredited early roles. Blues Busters, Outlaws of Texas, Valentino from 1951, not the Ken Russell one, Nevada Badman, Canyon Raiders, Oklahoma Justice, a lot of westerns, Racket Squad, the TV show, The Gunman, Fargo, no, not that one, this is from 1952, Flat Top, Invasion USA, no, not that one, the one from 1952, The Maverick, not the TV show or the film, or that film, but from 1952 as well. Scorching Fury. And then, 24 episodes of The Adventures of Superman. She would be replaced by Noel Neal. And went and did a slew of TV and movies like Topeka, Here Come the Girls, El Paso Stampede. And the list goes on and on. So thank you to Phyllis Coates. As well as film director Terrence Davies, man, reading's a skill, who he passed away this week as well. 15 credits to his name, including the Terrence Davies trilogy of Death and Transfiguration, Madonna and Child and Children, Distant Voices, Still Lives with a young Pete, well, young for him, Pete Postlethwaite, The Long Day Closes, The Neon Bible. The first film of his I got to see was The House of Mirth that had Gillian Anderson in it from 2000. Of Time in the City, The Deep Blue Sea, not that one, the one from 2011, Sunset Song, A Quiet Passion, But Why, and Benediction. So salute to Terrence. Okay. So catching up on some videos this week, I got to see from IndiePix, a film from Luxembourg called Io Sto Bene, which is translated into I Am Fine. And we have a story of Antonio, who is an aging retired widower. Lots of flashbacks in this one of him meeting a girl while working in Luxembourg. He was Italian and now living in Luxembourg. So he finds another Italian living in Luxembourg. It almost looks like it's going to go down the Lost in Translation path. It does not. But we do get Antonio flashbacks as a young man, meeting a girl, cheating with his best friend's girl before their engagement, and then finding out that the girl that he had met and was supposed to be in love with, and she's pregnant. Meanwhile, we have a young woman who is working as a VJ, yeah, not just for MTV anymore, away from her family. She also finds out she's pregnant. So we have two kind of lost souls from similar backgrounds who are able to bond, and he's trying to help her out. So nice little picture from Luxembourg called I Am Fine. Also from Kino Lorber, a film called The Beast, which was the big Goya Awards winning. This is the Academy Awards in Spain. This won 9 awards plus Best Picture. And it's a story of Antoine, who is a French organic farmer working with his wife in the Spanish countryside. And there's tension building between some of the locals and the other farmers and Antoine because he did not sign on to do a wind turbine. He's going full organic and full natural. And there's some straw dogs level taunting in the bars next door. Things are starting to, people are starting to mess with the family's crops. People threw batteries, car batteries in their water supply, and tension is growing. And I'm happy to say, much to my surprise, it does not turn into straw dogs. It doesn't turn into the Hatfields and McCoys. There is a different type of family tension, a lot of which I cannot give away. Although if you see the cover of the DVD case, you'll know kind of what happens. But very tense and just unpleasant enough, I guess uncomfortable enough, before it doesn't turn into a bummer, a complete and utter bummer fest. But well done, and I understand why it won Best Picture at the Goya Awards when it came out. So from Kino Lorber, The Beast. Also from Kino Lorber, and this is one where I can't believe I didn't see this one, but it's the 1990 neo-noir film After Dark, My Sweet, with Jason Patrick, who is a former boxer, now drifter, who comes across a very attractive widow played by Rachel Ward, and an associate of hers, who is an uncle, but not her uncle, played by Bruce Dern. And he gets drawn, Uncle Bud is Bruce Dern's character's name, and he gets drawn into a kidnapping plot, which, of course, things do not go according to plan. And this is directed by James Foley. This is based on a novel by Jim Thompson. And James Foley is one of those, I don't think I've ever seen a film of his that it's kind of like, there's some polarizing tastes like licorice, and there's also coconut. Either people really like it or really don't like it. And I think I'm that way with James Foley's films. If you remember, 1984's Reckless, which was also a film I saw, I believe, before the Suburban Fairy Tales of Mr. John Hughes, so I got to see teen angst at a different level. He directed several Madonna videos, Live to Tell, Papa Don't Preach, True Blue, but he also did At Close Range, which is a really underrated crime drama from 1986 with Sean Penn and Christopher Walken. He then directed Who's That Girl? After Dark, My Sweet, we mentioned. He did the Glengarry Glen Ross, which I absolutely loved, and I was in college, and it just kind of hit at the right time. Two Bits, which is an interesting follow-up with Al Pacino that's not Glengarry Glen Ross. Fear, I didn't like at all. The Chamber, which was, I think, the fourth adaptation of a John Grisham novel that didn't quite do it. The Corruptor, Confidence, which I need to revisit both of those. Perfect Strangers, another one I kind of have to revisit. Did 12 episodes of House of Cards, and then he did the last two 50 Shades films. So, but the ones of his I really do like, and this one is in that category. I'm a noir sucker, and we get a kind of twitchy performance from Jason Patrick. Always good to see Rachel Ward, perfect as a femme fatale. And Bruce Dern brings Bruce Dern-like things to this noir, which is mostly set in the very sun-baked, like, Southern California desert. And it's well done. So look for After Dark, My Sweet from Kino Lorber. I also revisited the 1987 Burt Reynolds film Malone, which was a part of the kind of trilogy of Burt trying to be an action star once again with Stick, Malone, Heat, and Malone in that order, 85, 86, 87. And I remember seeing this in the theater and liking it a lot. It still holds up as kind of Burt Reynolds' version of Shane. And in more than one interview, he has talked about the comparisons to Shane. It also probably didn't help matters that 2 years before Malone, Clint Eastwood did his own version of Shane, known as the Western Pale Rider. Reynolds also made comparisons to Stallone, I think only because it was shot in Canada and it was supposed to be set in the Pacific Northwest. But Reynolds plays an ex-CIA assassin who walks away from his work, from his job. He has car trouble in a small Pacific Northwestern town, which is being gobbled up by a right-wing zealot played by Cliff Robertson. He winds up staying in town and helping out with a gas station attendant and his way too young for Burt teenage daughter, played by Cynthia Gibb. Scott Wilson plays the dad. Lauren Hutton is also in this, who's Burt's old protege and current lover, and she was also assigned by the CIA to take out Reynolds. So it's kind of Reynolds taking on the bad guys one by one before we get a Heat-level shootout where Reynolds takes out the bad guys one by one. It's an interesting time for action movies in this time in the 1980s because Reynolds is older. Charles Bronson's found a home at Cannon Films. So did Charles Bronson. Chuck Norris and Charles Bronson. But Stallone has taken over things as the action star. Eddie Murphy has become an action star. A year after this, Bruce Willis. So a whole new generation of action stars are coming in. And Reynolds, who'd had a bad streak of luck in the mid-80s with the injury on City Heat and some financial issues and bad press, is just trying to keep his head above water. Reportedly got $3 million for Malone, and he was looking for bigger checks at that point. And I like Stick, even though it's, you know, nothing to do with the Elmer Leonard novel. And Heat, you know, if he hadn't punched the director, we might have had a different story. And in this one, it's, like I said, it's his version of Shane with more gunfire and obviously a stuntman doing some of Burt's work. But this is a plot where he's one of these intricate assassins who's very good at his job. And this would be the setup for – this would be the template, I should say, for a slew of action films from the 90s that would plague theaters as well as straight-to-video titles. So, you know, guys like Steven Seagal would make a slew of these later on in time. So – but yeah, it's fun. It was fun to revisit Malone. I was 17, and this was a pizza and beer film for me, so I enjoyed that. Another film out from Kino Lorber, and Malone came out earlier this year from Kino Lorber. This is another title from Kino Lorber that came out earlier, and I got it during a sale. The 1973 spy action film That Man Bolt, starring Gary Indiana's own Fred the Hammer Williamson. And in this one, he plays Thomas Bolt, who is a professional courier. He is able to transport things from point A to point B, and he is taken out of prison and in Hong Kong, and is given a job to transport money from Hong Kong to Los Angeles to Mexico City, and of course, things do not go as planned, and. Listening to the interview with Williamson that came on this Blu-ray, it was supposed to be part of a three-picture deal with Universal Pictures. This is not a blaxploitation film. This is a spy film. This is Bond-level material. We get a lot of shootouts. We get to see Fred Williamson do his own fights. We get to see him do a little globe traveling and bed with any woman of any color, because that's one of Fred's three rules. You can't kill him. He gets the girl if he wants him, if he wants her, and you can't kill him, and he survives. So he avenges. But and that's again on the DVD and the Blu-ray. But there's a couple of great moments of Fred Williamson moments. One involving a car chase where he's driving a Cadillac, and it's the Cadillac that goes under the trunk bed, where he drops down, and of course the top of the car is completely ripped out. And then next thing you know, you see Fred pop up, one arm on the wheel, the other one over the across the leather seats, looking as calm and as cool as can be. Another moment where he's escaping a chase and winds up entering an airport through the baggage claim in an impeccable suit, wrinkle-free, cool as can be, going through the airport. So this came out in 1973. This is the same year that Live and Let Die and Enter the Dragon are both released. Now, Live and Let Die, of course, was considered the James Bond blaxploitation film because your villain is Yaphet Kotto, and we had scenes set in New Orleans and New York and Harlem. And, of course, Enter the Dragon, where Bruce Lee is also an agent for an organization who's supposed to go after Master Han. And by the way, the villain in this film, That Man Bolt, I believe has the same vocal performance as the guy who was the voice for Master Han in Enter the Dragon. And I believe the old English gentleman who gave Bruce Lee his assignment in Enter the Dragon does not have a mustache in this one, but also appears in That Man Bolt. So it's fun stuff. And Fred is able to, there's a great moment near the end of the film where he has to have yet another fight, and he exclaims that it's been a long night. So what could have been a franchise, maybe, according to Williamson in the interview that he did for this film on DVD and Blu-ray, he had a 3-picture deal with Universal. Fred thought it was going to be a series, and the studio said no, fearing that people would think this was a blaxploitation film. So he got paid for 2 films and was released from his contract. Now, full disclosure, I got to text Fred Williamson earlier this week as I was watching this. And I'll share what he talked to me was he got offered the money and rejected it. So I'm hoping to get Fred on fairly soon, if he's up for it, to talk about this film, as well as I heard him when he made an appearance during Watt Stacks, which was a part of a Stacks box set earlier this year. Anyway, to be fair, after this happened, Fred did get not really a series, but he did get to do 2 films for Paramount, one of which turned out to be their biggest moneymaker in 1974, The Legend of Charlie. There's a word there, I can't do it. And then there was the sequel, The Soul of Charlie. So anyway, he did get a series. He got it, but they were 2, and they were at Paramount. But this is a film that, in its packaging, kind of gets lumped into the soul cinema, and it's not a blaxploitation film. It's a good spy film, and it's worth checking out. It's called That Man Bolt, and even in the ad campaign, Universal has he's bonded. So they were going that way. But from Kino Lorber, Fred Williamson in That Man Bolt. And with that in mind, friends, good segue, we're going to go back to my 2014 interview with Fred the Hammer Williamson. Now, if I remember right, at the time of this interview, because I've interviewed Fred on a few occasions for Film Threat magazine, which was my big publishing moment in 1996 on the set of Original Gangsters, Chicago Cigar Magazine. I'd interviewed him for The Art of the Matter for this the old arts program for this show. And then I think for that one was Hoosiers and Cinema, because he was born and raised in Gary. Anyway, from 2014 into the archives, my chat with Fred the Hammer Williamson. Enjoy. Joining me on Film Sociology, well, let's see, actor, director, star, producer, writer, football rebel, cigar aficionado, and he was my very first professional film interview, so he's my good luck charm, but he's a good luck charm that could knock your teeth in, Fred the Hammer Williamson. How you doing, Hammer?
The Hammer is in the house.
And no admission for Hammer. He gets in. He gets in around the velvet rope.
People know you and respect you. That's all that really counts, dude.
Exactly. Now, as I brought up, the first time I interviewed you was on the set of Original Gangsters in downtown Gary, and we've now come full circle because you want to make Original Gangsters 2. Tell us all about it.
Well, I think it's a film that needs to be made. You know, when I'm walking down the street and people remember all the films that I've done, but they seem to be latched onto this terminology as OG. So from doing Original Gangsters, I picked up another nickname, which is OG.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, if the fans feel that way, then the picture should be made. But I've had tremendous difficulty trying to influence Hollywood that this is a picture that should be made, and it would be a successful picture. Because I'm bringing back all the same cast, and people want to see what their old heroes look like. They want to see what Jim Brown looks like, if he can still fight. Richard Roundtree still has that image of Bernie Casey, you know, is as popular as he was before. We have Pam Grier. We have Antonio Fargas. We have Robert Forster. I want to do a film to give back the images that the people first saw them, so that, you know, they can get back some credibility in their careers and maybe move forward in other projects in Hollywood.
And
we don't want them to be just forgotten, you know.
Absolutely. And it's interesting because in the last few years, there have been a number of action films. I won't name names, but they seem to have their own version of an all-star team. But you did this almost 20 years ago with Original Gangsters back in 96.
Well, it's ironic. As soon as I finished the film, I got a call from Stallone saying, was it working with all your old friends? And I said, listen, you pay them, and everybody has a good time. So he came out with his, Indispensables, or Dispendables, or whatever it was, okay. And now he's on Dispendable number 13, and I can't get number 2 off the ground, dude. So it's Hollywood really has made a lot of strides from days of yesteryear.
Well, and you're going via Kickstart, and as somebody who works in public radio, we know where pledge dollars really come in as far as support. Tell folks what they can do to become a part of Original Gangsters 2.
Well, we put the program on Kickstart. I think the problem that we did is that we put it on too close to the holidays when people were short of money, because we're not really burning up the wires and getting the money in, but I think it's because of the holidays. So maybe when it's over, it runs out mid-February. So if we haven't made the budget that we want by then, we'll pull it off and maybe give it another shot later on when people have more money and understand that the project is there and it needs to be funded.
So if people want to know more about the project and maybe want to kick in a few bucks, where can they go?
Well, they go to www.kickstarter, and it gives you all the information and it tells you what you get. You know, we can't give them any proceeds, but we can, you know, do things to make them happy. We'll give them signed scripts from all the players. We'll give them photos, autographed pictures, personal autographed to them by all the players. So, you know, it's something that needs to be done, and I hope that we can get it done.
And ladies and gentlemen, this is better than the coffee mugs and tote bags that we have here, so go for it.
Well, this is original stuff, you know. This is a one-time original, and a script. You know, later on will be worth some money because, you know, I think the film will be popular and we'll probably do another one. You know, this is old school number 2. If it works out with old school 3, we're just old school on down the road, dude.
Exactly. Now, you wrote the script. Can you tell us a little bit? Can you give us a little tease on what OG2 is going to be about?
Well, I'm trying to keep everything current. You know, this one has a boxing background. Jim and Pam still live in Gary. They now run a boxing gym, and they have discovered a real jewel within their confines. And what happens is that the bad guys who run the casino on the ship, on the boat, the gambling boat, decide they want to buy the guy from Jim because they can do something for him that they feel Jim can't. Jim doesn't want to sell, so they try to muscle him and strong arm him. And that's when we come into play. I says, okay, you guys want to play that way? We'll show you how to do that.
Because muscling Jim Brown wasn't a bad idea enough already.
No, but they didn't know that he was surrounded by Fred Williamson and Richard Roundtree and Bernie Casey. So we step up to the plate and said, you don't want to do that, guys.
Another example of experience over youth.
Putting a team together, you know, working together as a team. And it's a good opportunity for each guy to bring back the image that made him popular from the beginning.
And, yeah, watching the original Gangsters was so much fun. I always remember it opened the same weekend as Twister, and you made more money per capita on your film than I think that film did. There's not a whole lot of overhead, I assume, on your films.
Well, it shows you how stupid the majors are. I mean, how stupid can you be to open up a film that got so much publicity as Twister? Even though Twister was a bomb, it didn't do anything. But the publicity that they put out on Twister way outshined what we did. And we beat them in every way. We had per theater, more people coming to see the film. We beat them out in the first 2 or 3 weeks with no publicity, not equal to what they put out. So, you know, you can't fool the public. You got to give them what they like, and if they don't like it, they're not going to see it, no matter how much money you spend in trying to make them come to the theater.
And you also had a heads up decades ago, because it's not just American money that comes into play. There's a lot of actors, and you're one, of course, that makes money globally. So there's more out there that, you know, you shouldn't be a xenophobe when it comes to money.
Well, I never bought into the idea that black films or films with have black stars don't make money in the foreign market. I never bought into that because 90% of my girlfriends were all from Spain or Germany or Italy. So trying to tell me they don't like me, are you crazy? So in 1975, I made a film called Adios Amigo. I took 3 cans of film under my arm straight to Cannes. I went to Cannes in 1975. I went to the Carlton Terrace where everybody hangs out, and all the big celebrities and all the big producers and all the majors. And I gave the maitre d' $50 a day to save a table for me on the patio. So I could sit in right in the middle of everybody and put my flyers down and put my poster down. I started with the T-shirt girls, with the wet T-shirt girls walking around with Adios Amigo on the T-shirt.
Mm-hmm.
And I proved to myself, which I wasn't trying to prove to Hollywood because Hollywood will consider that you're lucky. I didn't really care what Hollywood thought. I wanted to be sure that what I thought was right. And I walked away. I made the picture for $75,000. I came away with almost $500,000 in sales. So, you know, I broke that concept wide open. But Hollywood still don't buy into it because they think, you know, well, Hammer, you're different. You're lucky. Not lucky. You just got to understand what the people want to see.
Yeah, 35, 40 years, that's not a luck streak. That's just business.
Understanding who your public is.
Mm-hmm.
Understanding who your public is. Making a film that the public wants to see, that your fans want to see. You can't surprise them. They like you to see. They like you seeing you doing certain things all the time. I mean, they talk about Hollywood, so you're typecast. Yeah, I'm typecast, but I'm having fun. I like what I'm doing, so that means gainful employment. So I like what I'm doing. Why the heck should I change?
Well, and it's funny you mentioned that. When did you establish the Hammer rules?
When I first got into Hollywood, when I first came into Hollywood, I wanted to come in under the same image that I had left in pro football,
uh-huh,
as the Hammer. You know, a guy who stands up for something and not afraid of what you believe in and not be afraid to speak up and talk. So when I came to Hollywood, I had called a press conference, and I said, I got 3 rules in Hollywood. I'm coming to be a hero, and my 3 rules are, you can't kill me in a movie, I have to win all my fights in a movie, and I get the girl at the end of the movie if I want it. Now, you do 2 out of 3 of those, and I'm working for you. It's not about money. You can't buy my integrity because my integrity is not for sale. I know who I am. I know what I represent to my public. I know what I represent to the black audience. So that's, you know, that's my longevity. That's why I haven't disappeared like a lot of actors have, black actors who made the so-called black exploitation movies back in the day. Their movies were all about get whitey. They were, mm-hmm, retribution movies. I killed black people, white people, yellow people, pink people. I killed everybody. If you were a bad guy, you went down. So trying to fit me into that black exploitation genre, it just never worked.
And I think your response to that was your checks cleared. Well, who's being exploited?
Exactly. I mean, the audience were being happy when the smoke cleared. The black guy was still standing, you know. Not, you know, don't kill me and have Schwarzenegger avenge my death. Kill Schwarzenegger. Let me avenge his death. You know, don't kill me in the first 5 minutes of the movie and then talk about me throughout the rest of the movie. I'm not going for that. I want the reversal of that.
Well, when I was a kid, my dad would take me, and you know, my dad wasn't putting his arm around me like Atticus Finch informing me that he was taking me to a black action movie. He took me to see Black Caesar. You know, it was no different than watching Burt Reynolds or Charles Bronson.
Exactly.
You just,
exactly.
You had flashier clothes. That was about it.
Yeah, well, my image of Black Caesar came from watching Edward G. Robinson in Little Caesar.
Right.
I wanted to be the guy that was questionable. Is he a good, bad guy, or is he a bad, good guy? He kills people, but he only kills bad people, and he helps the little ladies across the street, and he gives flowers to people. So is he a bad guy, or is he a good guy? So as long as you keep that question, Clint Eastwood, Charles Bronson, are they good bad guys or bad good guys? I mean, those are my heroes.
Yep. A little gray matter goes really well with a white suit.
It's the thought process that counts, dude.
Well, it's funny. You mentioned those rules. I came across an episode of Julia, and there were two of those rules. You won the court case, and you got Diane Carroll.
Well, I had a name called Steve Bruce, dude. I mean, it was a loser from the beginning. I had two first names, Steve Bruce. I'm going, I got to get out of this image as fast as I can. And I happened to be in a 20th Century Fox lot where we made the film, where we were shooting Julia. Guy walks up to me in the commissary and he says, I'm making a movie. I got a football scene in it. I don't really know that much about football. Would you direct the football stuff and put all the football players together and bring them in so we can have a believable football game? So, yeah, no problem. The movie was MASH.
Yep.
The guy that talked to me was Ingo Preminger.
Mm-hmm. And you helped out Altman with the football scenes. How hard did you tell the players to hit?
No, it was real. It was no fake out there. It was no exhibition game there. Because, it was my credibility on the line. So, let's hit people. Let's take it out. You guys are all ex-football players. I got the only non-football players were Elliot Gould and
Donald Sutherland.
Donald Sutherland and Tom Skerritt. The rest of the guys were semi-pros because at that time they had semi-pro teams in the Bay Area. And I brought all the semi-pro teams in. Plus, I sprinkled a few pros in there. I had Ben Davison in there. I had Jimmy Brown in there. So I sprinkled some pros in there to make sure we got some good hitting. So it was a realistic adventure.
When Original Gangsters 2 gets made, I should say when, not if, we need to get a 20th anniversary 2-disc collection of the first one. We need more commentaries from you, Fred. You have some of the best DVD commentaries out there.
Yeah, It helps sell the project. It alerts people to what it's about. It gives them an inside idea of what's going on while we make the film, and all that's fun. As long as what you have to say is real. There are things that you don't want to be known, but if you sprinkle a few of those into the commentary, it excites people. And as long as it's real and honest, they like it.
Speaking of real and honest, I am on your IMDb page. And there's some titles that are on your page, and I would like you to confirm or deny if these things are actually happening. Is that all right?
No problem.
Okay.
No problem.
There's a film that's in production called Life Outside.
Never heard of it.
Okay. Great. There's another one called it's in production, One Man's Vengeance.
Oh, yeah. That's my friend Jason. Jason Roth put that together.
Okay.
I think he's moved off. He's moved off of that onto Original Gangsters, but that was one idea that he was going to put together, that we were working together, but it was going to be a low-budget film. And I said, let's try Gangsters first. We can always go back to One Man's Vengeance because it's not as big a budget as Original Gangsters 2 is.
Okay, Sledge Johnson, that's good. All right, post-production, Beyond Control.
Never heard of it.
There's two. Another one in post-production, Billy Trigger.
Billy Trigger I made in Montreal, Canada. That's a good action film. It's like Black Caesar character that I played. That's going to be a good one.
Okay. Another one in post-production, Atomic Eden.
I made that in Germany. Hitler had an atomic weapon that he hid in one of his bunkers, and the bad guys are trying to get it, and I got to beat the bad guys to it before they get it, because they plan on doing damage with it. So I just want to know that the world is safe. I got it.
And you're not inglorious in this one.
Well, I didn't want to go inglorious because Quentin might try to copy that one too,
Uh-huh. Well, we'll get to Quentin in just a second. And then there's something that's filming called Sticky Fingers, the movie.
That was something done a long time ago. Sticky Fingers is a dog. Yeah.
All right. So just, and then
the movie stars a dog.
Oh, literally a dog.
Yeah.
Okay.
A dog.
And then there's two other titles that are in pre-production, but I think, this conversation you and I are having are in pre-production, so I'm just going to let that slide. out of curiosity, do you ever think the Charlie films will ever come out on DVD and Blu-ray or see the light of day?
I think they're afraid to, man. I mean, if they come out, when they first made them, in the East Coast, it was The Legend of Nigger Charlie, and then on the West Coast, it was The Legend of Charlie, just like Boss Nigger.
Right.
Boss Nigger was okay in the East Coast, but when it came West, it was Boss.
Mm-hmm.
So now these films are Boss and Charlie. But you can't find Charlie, but you can find Boss. I don't understand that. Charlie just buried it.
Mm-hmm.
The only reason you find Boss is because I produced it, and I put the distribution together. So it's a whole different ballgame. But Paramount's sitting on Charlie. I don't know what they'll probably never release it at all.
I wondered after after Django Unchained came out, because I think those films were both heavily an influence on Django Unchained. I'm wondering if they would pop up out of nowhere, but apparently not happening.
Well, it's amazing that the New York Times did a big article about the film and about how close it was to Charlie and how much that Quentin had taken from the movie. So it's not like people are not aware of the fact that the film was made and the film is out there. And they're unaware of the fact that Quentin took a lot from it.
Hmm.
It took my wardrobe, first of all. It took my horse, my clothes, my gun, my hat, my cape. It took my whole wardrobe from Charlie and put it on Quentin's star.
Your character could have trained Jamie Foxx, but then again, you probably would have shoved Jamie Foxx out of the way and taken care of it yourself.
Yeah, well, you know, Jamie Foxx is a great actor and he's a good guy, but he's no hammer.
Nobody is. So you still doing the Comic Cons? You doing the Gen Con type stuff?
Yeah. I mean, I'm doing them all over the world now. I got them in Germany. I'm in Berlin, Stitches, Barcelona. I'm everywhere.
We got to get you back in. Now, if when OG2 happens, will you film in Gary again?
Yeah, I'm going to start it in Gary, and I'll do the boxing stuff probably out here in California in one of the casinos. I'll use there's a big fight. My production value, the main production value of the film will be in a big arena with thousands of people watching. And what I'll do is shoot between a major fight. I'll shoot rounds anytime, you know, there's a break, I'll just run my players in there and shoot. And I already got that worked out.
Excellent. I will never forget the first time I met you. By the way, ladies and gentlemen, every Fred Williamson entrance is cinematic. I was parking on Main Street where you told me to park, and I get out and I get, it was like late at night, and I'm getting my microphone, getting my camera, get my recorder, and I see somebody on the sidewalk, and of course my brain said, no eye contact. And I looked up and head to toe walking down, no entourage, head to toe in black, there you were. And you said hi, and I said, I'm supposed to interview you. And you went, that's right. And you just said, follow me, and walked right onto the set.
I'm not an entourage guy, man. You know, I don't need a whole bunch of people cheering for me and walking behind me. That's not my thing. Yo, this is Fred the Hammer Williamson, and you're listening to Film Sociology on WFYI in Naptown. Know what I'm saying? Keep listening. You might learn something.
From 2014, my interview with Fred the Hammer Williamson, I think my two favorite taglines for Film Sociology are Elmore Leonard saying it's a real show, it's great, even though he never heard it, and Fred Williamson, you might learn something. So thank you, Hammer. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Once again, IndieBardFest.com to find out all the shows, including As You Like It, which yours truly is in. Troilus and Cressida is also this weekend. We have Medea, Titus Andronicus, Had a Gobbler, as well as the original, which is now I've Lost My Mind. A Bold Stroke for a Husband. See, friends, reading is a skill. Hopefully we're going to have Sammy Terry on very soon here on these airwaves, because it is that time of the year for him. But let's go around the horn, and then we'll grab a pencil, and we'll find out what you've been watching this week. We go over to the Tibbs Drive-In. Once again, I've said it many times, I love drive-in theaters in October. Just, you know, bring a sweater and a blanket. It'll be fine. But on Screen One this weekend, Corpse Bride, Coraline, and then they play Corpse Bride again. Screen Two, Taylor Swift Eras Tour, When Evil Lurks, and Saw 10. On Screen Three, Taylor Swift Eras Tour, The Exorcist Believer, and The Nun 2. And then on Screen 4, Taylor Swift Eras Tour, Friday the 13th Part 2 and Friday the 13th Part 3. I don't think it's in 3D, so there you go over at the Tibbs Drive-In. Over at the Skyline Drive-In this weekend, The Exorcist Believer followed by The Evil Dead 2. And, of course, Monday, October 16th is the double feature of Final Cut followed by Slice. That is happening over there. On October 20th, at the Skyline is the original Exorcist along with the Exorcist Believer. That is also happening on the 22nd. And, of course, Indie Sensations is, that's 2020. That is coming up on the 25th. So check that out at the Skyline Drive-In. Over at IU Cinema tonight as part of Friday Night Frights, Friday the 13th, Part 2 from 1981. On Tuesday, October 17th, at 7 p.m., Recorder, the Marion Stokes Project. On Thursday the 19th, at 7 p.m., Free Angela and All Political Prisoners. That's from 2012. Friday, October 20th, at 7 p.m., Property. Friday, October 20th, as a part of Friday Night Frights, Friday, October 20th at 10 p.m., Audition. Saturday, October 21st at 4 p.m. from 1933 is Babyface. Saturday, October 21st at 7 p.m. is Property. Tuesday, October 24th at 7 p.m. from 2022, RMN. And then Wednesday, October 25th. Ooh, this has got a Criterion release, but this is at 7 p.m., Wednesday, October 25th, new 4K restoration, special guest scheduled to appear, they won't tell you who, David Cronenberg's Videodrome. So go check that out. At the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin this weekend, 2 and 7:30 p.m. on the 13th and the 14th. Yes, I know it's Friday the 13th when this podcast came out, whatever. Sunday, 2 and 5 p.m., Hocus Pocus. It has to be done. Friday, October 20th at 7:30 p.m. is a part of the Universal Horror Monster Madness, This Island Earth, not the Mystery Science Theater treatment. Saturday, October 21st at 2 p.m., House of Frankenstein from 1944. Saturday, October 21st at 5 p.m., Son of Frankenstein from 1939. Saturday, October 21st at 7:30 p.m. with Sammy Terry, The Black Cat from 1939. And then Saturday, 9:30 p.m., October 21st from 1939, Sammy Terry will be there, Island of Lost Souls. And then Friday and Saturday, 2 and 7:30 p.m., October 27th and 28th, the musical Little Shop of Horrors. That is happening over at the Historic Art Craft Theater. Once again, SammyTerry.com for all the information there. Over at Golan Globus Theater, they're doing their Vincent Price Month, and this week they are doing Dr. Fibes Rises Again. And you might be hearing me in a couple weeks. Just keep a post on that. But it's been fun to hear the Vincent Price stories happening over there. This week on You Must Remember, this is about... In the series of Erotic 90s, Lolita's Volume 3, Wild Things, Cruel Intentions, and, yep, Britney Spears. So that is happening over there. All right, friends, grab a pencil. Let's find out what you've been watching. Hopefully you got to watch some good films that are new, or at least new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. We start on Facebook with Doug, who writes the 100th anniversary of Souls for Sale, and two from my Chicago and film class, Bad Boys from 1983, and Chicago, the musical from 2002. Nick Rogers writes The Exorcist Believer, Demons, which I got to see at the Artcraft Theater. By the way, I'm wearing my Goblin shirt right now. The Return of Swamp Thing, Guys at Parties Like It, The Mother of Tears, Night Beasts, Ebola Syndrome, The Beyond, and The Kane Mutiny Court Martial, which I need to get to. Lou Harry writes, Kansas City, Haunted Mansion, Frankenstein and the Monster from Hell, Horror of Frankenstein, Evil of Frankenstein. Ryan, who is also an As You Like It with me, writes, The Creator, and loved it. Eric's first views, Suspiria, the original Suspiria, and Performance, as well as Friedkin's Final Bow, a modest production of the Kane Mutiny Court Martial. I liked Friedkin as a filmmaker, obviously, and his film adaptations of plays pretty good, pretty diverse between The Boys in the Band, Bug, 12 Angry Men, and now this. So I am fascinated. His rewatches, The Old Dark House from 1932, and Tron, which I hadn't seen since it was in theaters. I did ask Eric about how he liked Suspiria, my first Argento, oodles of style. I was surprised at the crudity of some of the gory, icky scenes. Yeah, that's kind of Italian horror. but I chalked it up to that budget. Definitely enjoyed seeing Aida Valli and Joan Bennett in late career appearances as evil old ladies. Very good. Howell writes, Abbott and Costello meet Frankenstein. Amanda went to the library, Scream, Pig, Sleepwalkers, Stephen King's Bad of Bones, Terror Train, 1922, The Fog, Prom Night 2, and wait, the first two. Oh, this is great. This is one of those compilations, gang, on DVD. It's the Jamie Lee Curtis Prom Night collection, but it features Prom Night with Jamie Lee Curtis, and then Prom Night 2, Hello Mary Lou, and Prom Night 4, Deliver Us From Evil, neither have Jamie Lee Curtis in it, and they couldn't get the part 3. So, anyway, gotta love those video collections. She also watched November Criminals, Agatha Christie's Crooked House, A Street Cat Named Bob. Okay. Daniel writes, Scoop, The Guilt Trip, L.A. Confidential, Bye Bye Birdie, Stalag 17, The Lesson, Madonna of the Seven Moons, Bo is Afraid, The Killers, and Baby Steps. JJ writes, first watches The Town, which should have been called Reheat, Reptile, watched it for Benicio del Toro's performance, and The Sentinel, wild post-Rosemary Baby New York City apartment terror. Yes, a bananas watch for October. I agree, JJ. That one's fairly bonkers. Eric writes, No One Will Save You, exactly how I felt about this movie, and the first Conjuring. Jamie writes, Corpse Bride, The Halloween Tree, Ghost Adventures, Devil's Island, Sleepy Hollow, Double Double Toil and Trouble, the two Maleficent films, Haunted Mansion this year, Addams Family Animated, and Dark Shadows from 2012. Gary writes, The Addiction, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Mutant Mayhem, LA Confidential, The Hot Flashes, Street People, and The Blair Witch Project. Terry writes, from the last 2 weeks, Tales of Terror, The Raven, The Haunted Palace, The Mask of the Red Death, The Tomb of Ligeria, The Day After Trinity, The Unbelievable Truth, Trust, The Rapture, Moscow Mission, and 1931's Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Somebody's been on the Criterion Channel. Jessica writes, Terrified, Prince of Darkness, Haunted Mansion, VHS 94, says she fell asleep, and The Beyond from 1983. David writes, Napoleon Dynamite, in preparation for our visit with the actors from the movie. Okay. As well, really? They're coming to the Seeger Auditorium? Okay, cool. Good luck. And then the Ben Stiller version of The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, as well as The Secret Life of Pets. And finally, Kelly writes, Totally Killer, Shut In, and A Haunting in Venice. And that's what you've been watching this week, friends. So hopefully you got to watch some fun films, some good films that are new or at least new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. Friends, some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's some out there. As You Like It, Friday and Saturday night at 8 o'clock at Mud Creek Players. Sunday at 2:30. Go to IndieBardFest.com for all the ticket information. Golden Globus Theater, of course, is doing Dr. Fives Rises again. And we'll hopefully have some company next week. So thank you for listening. Take care, everybody. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
Okay. We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!